Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us today are former Pentagon Comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Dr. Ilan Berman of the American Foreign Policy Council, who have been writing thoughtfully about the 25-year strategic partnership being negotiated between Tehran and Beijing. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri, Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, great to be back.
Absolute pleasure, Ilan. It's been too long. You've both crafted very, very thoughtful pieces on this. Obviously, there's a lot of reporting on the issue, as well as other thoughtful voices. Barry Pavel of the Atlantic Council, mentioned that this is the first major strategic deal between Beijing and a major power in a very long time. As you both observed, the Iranian economy is in free fall, so this deal would constitute an important lifeline for Tehran. China also gets benefits. And oh, by the way, this comes at a time when Chinese investment in Israel is increasing and Beijing is building closer links to Jerusalem. Dov, start us off. What are your concerns with this deal and how does this change the regional strategic dynamic? Because for each action, like the Trump administration's pressure, a maximum pressure campaign, there's an equal and opposite reaction oftentimes.
Well, that's exactly right. I have multiple concerns. Let's start with the fact that one of the things we've been saying about China is that it has no allies. Well, I don't know if this is called a formal alliance, but when you have what both sides are calling a strategic partnership, when you have China not only investing $400 billion, but as you pointed out, they're going to get benefits and not just Iranian oil. There's going to be joint military and technological cooperation. They'll probably be involved in managing Iranian facilities on the Persian Gulf. This is no small business. And so that's a concern right there. What is going on between Iran and China that all of a sudden is not without an ally? Secondly, China has been very heavily invested in Israel for the past number of years, mostly in almost virtually in the high tech area. The United States is not happy about this. The Israelis don't have a CFIUS, a Committee on Foreign Investment type arrangement that we do. They keep saying, well, our intelligence people stay on top of this. It's not clear to me that they stay on top of it. It's not clear to me they want to stay on top. So China is investing heavily in Israel. It's now investing heavily in Iran. What does that mean? It means that the Chinese, far more than the United States, are in a position to ensure that there's a degree of stability in the Middle East, but of course that favors them. They will tell the Israelis, don't you dare hit Iran, we've got to deal with them. And they'll tell the Iranians, don't you dare hit Israel, we've got to deal with them. That is something that we simply didn't anticipate several years ago. And oh, by the way, the Chinese are very heavily invested in Saudi Arabia's nuclear program. Given that, you now have essentially the three major actors in the Middle East, all of whom are now closely tied to China at a time when the United States, or at least the president of the United States, or at least the current president of the United States, insists that we need to get out of this region. And of course, wants to do that without consultation with our allies in Europe and in the Far East, and particularly Japan and Korea, that depend very much on Middle Eastern oil. So this could affect the balance, not just in the Middle East, but if the Chinese really get their nails into everything Middle Eastern, they could, if they wanted to, choke off Japan and Korea as well. This has some major ramifications that, unfortunately, this administration simply does not seem to have its arms around.
And I should point out, right, that the Saudis bought Chinese unmanned aerial systems, which indicates that some of those feeds obviously would be shared with the Chinese at the end of the day. And also there is that strategic agreement between Pakistan and China as well, as China's
and
Djibouti,
not...
right? Djibouti.
Well, there's Djibouti. I mean, if you want to talk about a string of pearls, you already have you have Sri Lanka, you have your Gwadar in Pakistan, you will have Iran, you have them managing the Israeli ports of Haifa and Ashdod, which happen to be the places where the Israeli Navy is right next door, and right. you have Djibouti. So you now have a Chinese road, sea-based road, that clearly has strategic implications. And again, is essentially encircling the United States in the Indian Ocean.
Ilan, give us your sense and take on what all of this means as well, because I know that you've joined us and discussed some of these angles over the last couple of years.
Sure. Well, no, I think Dov outlined it masterfully. And I think, the key point here is that it is a strategic alliance, right? In all its glory, but it's also an unequal one, right? So to understand this properly, I think you have to look at it from the Iranian angle and also from the Chinese angle. From the Iranian angle, it's very clear that this is a reaction on the part of the Iranian regime to the Trump administration's maximum pressure policy. Because historically, the Iranian regime has adopted a policy of what they call strategic patience, right? So their plan, not to put it too bluntly, was simply to try to wait Trump out. And they were getting counsel on that, from people like former Secretary of State John Kerry. But increasingly, the Iranian economic situation has grown so dire, and it's been amplified by the corrosive effects of the fact that the regime has botched its response to the coronavirus very, very significantly, to the point where the clock is ticking very loudly. And more, if you look at what the Iranian authorities are saying, they've come to the conclusion that they have to abandon strategic patience and they have to make other moves in order to preserve their rule. And this is part of that, I think, and it's a very big part of that. And if you see what's happening within the country, there is a tremendous amount of discontent among ordinary Iranians about what looks to be a very significant erosion of Iranian national sovereignty, right? China becomes the partner of choice, not only as a destination for Iranian oil, but also China becomes the sort of corporate entity, the main driver of modernization of Iranian telecom, of building all sorts of infrastructure projects. This deal, if it's fully actualized, really tethers Iran to China in a very organic way, and in a way that frankly peels back a lot of the gains that the regime has made over time. And I think, the sobering conclusion here is the regime has figured out that it's better to be still in charge of a diminished Islamic Republic than to be out of business at all.
So how does Washington need to respond to this, given the kind of delicacy that's required in negotiating this? Because in the wake of the collapse of the JCPOA, the Joint Coordinated Plan of Action, that was the multinational deal to stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons, not for Iran to be a nice guy, but just to stop developing nuclear weapons. Obviously, the Iranians, we abandoned the deal, and it's obvious the Iranians have abandoned the deal ultimately as well. Dov, how does the administration and the United States and its allies, what does the United States need to do? Let's not even talk about allies. How does the United States need to proceed on this?
Actually, you're right. We do have to talk about allies. I don't see how we do this alone anymore. Going it alone has led to where we are today. Now, the first thing we need to do is, frankly, to get on board with our allies, because they are being penetrated by the Chinese as well. Certainly the European allies are. And those are the ones that were involved in the JCPOA. And secondly, it's not just that they're being penetrated, is that if there's any way to wean the Iranians off China, there has to be some alternate approach. At this stage of the game, to say we're going to choke you off isn't credible. And to say we're not going to do anything isn't credible. We're going to have to do something. Now, the problem, of course, is that the president continues to believe that he can do everything by himself and the United States can do everything by itself. And that's simply not going to work. And we can try to pressure the Israelis not to do business with China. But by the way, we've been pressuring the Israelis. Let me see now. How far back does it go? It must be at least 30 or 35 years that we've been telling the Israelis not to sell military equipment to China. They keep saying, oh, of course we don't. And then we catch them out. So, it's certainly when it comes to dual use or when it comes to investments where you can't even follow, because CFIUS can't even follow at times who's really behind an investment. When it comes to that, it's going to be exceedingly difficult to stop the Israelis from doing business with the Chinese. We're not going to stop the Saudis from doing business with the Chinese. By the way, I should also add that the Chinese are doing a heck of a lot of business with Russia. That oil deal in 2013 that everybody said could not be fulfilled by Russia is pretty much halfway there already and is likely to be completed in terms of the 360-odd, I think it is, million barrels that they were supposed to come up with by next year. So they're doing business with Russia. They're doing business, which is, of course, heavily ensconced in Syria. They're doing business with Iran. They're doing business with Israel. They're doing business with the Saudis. They're in, as we both mentioned, Djibouti. I mean, we cannot simply say, oh, this is all fine. We're going to continue to squeeze the Iranians. It won't work.
I remember many years ago having dinner with a senior Israeli official in Tel Aviv, and he was explaining to me why it made sense for Israel to draw very close, and his rationale was very realpolitik. The United States was the world's leading superpower. It was important for Israel to have good relations with that power to protect its own interests. In order to protect our own interests, it's vital for us to have good relations with the Chinese so that when they become the world's leading superpower, there is a foundation of understanding and trust on that score. Ilan, what's your sense on how to respond to this? And the reason I sort of narrowed my question in the beginning to Dov to saying Washington, I believe all the cards for this reside in Washington, whether it wants to work with allies or not. What's the right way for the administration to proceed?
No, I think you're right. I very much think that the United States is driving the train here. But, as they say, the adversary also gets a vote. And this deal is very much a sea change in the way China is approaching or beginning to approach strategic competition in the context of the Middle East. Look, last year, China drew down its imports of oil from Iran by more than 50% in response to pressure from the Trump administration. But that was before the advent of, full-on great power competition. That was before the advent of the coronavirus. And this deal, I think, is a very clear signal that Beijing is pivoting towards a more confrontational approach. This deal puts China smack in the middle of the Trump administration's arguably most important strategic priority in the Middle East. And the question remains, what are we prepared to do about it? And it's not clear to me. I agree with Dov that it's certainly not an answer that we can provide on our own, but we should be thinking deeply right now what needs to happen in order to dissuade whether it's possible to dissuade the Chinese from fully actualizing this deal. But at least, immediately, it's very clear that this agreement has the potential to, if not totally demolish, then to significantly and negatively impact the Trump administration's maximum pressure policy. And if you're sitting in the State Department, if you're sitting in the National Security Council, you have to be very worried.
How do you guys think the administration, right? I mean, you guys talk to folks in the administration all the time. We all try to stay in touch with how the administration is thinking about these important questions. What do we know about the way the Trump administration is going to respond to this or not?
Well, first of all, they're probably going to wait to see if the deal is consummated. I think when Ilan mentioned that, you know, there isn't total unanimity in support of this. There's actually considerable concern on the part of lots of elements affiliated with the regime that, you know, Iran is in fact selling out to China. The key player, of course, is Khamenei, the supreme leader, who supports this deal for probably all the reasons that we've mentioned, the most important being keeping the regime on top, even if it means selling its soul. But there is opposition, and so the deal may or may not go through. And I think Elon just mentioned this, it's incumbent on Washington to do whatever it can, probably only through its allies. I mean, we don't talk to the Iranians, so it's got to be the allies that convince the Iranians that at the end of the day, those who oppose this deal are probably correct. But there has to be something that is given to them. Now, by pulling troops out of Germany, we're not helping keeping the Germans on board, for example, who were involved in the JCPOA. The Brits are totally engrossed in the COVID problem because they're the worst in the world. So they're not exactly the key leaders right now. Well, who are the other ones? You know, you're the Russians. You wind up discovering that we don't really have all that many people to work with, and we better reach out. And right now, I don't get the sense that the administration sees itself doing anything in partnership. Now, it'll threaten. It's been threatening allies with sanctions if they play with the Iranians. But this kind of brute force is not going to work if the allies don't want it to work. There are ways around, and the Chinese may help the allies with ways around. We haven't even thought about that. How will China help the allies who want to do business with Iran offset the whole American maximum pressure approach?
Ilan?
No, I think that's exactly right. And I mean, you can already see the way the transatlantic divide, the sort of the tensions that are inherent between the way the Trump administration is interacting with Europe, play out on the Trump administration's Iran policy. One of the big priorities that Secretary of State Pompeo and his point man on Iran, Brian Hook, have had for weeks now is to try to convince European countries to extend the arms embargo, the UN-mandated arms embargo on Iran that was part and parcel of the JCPOA. They're having all sorts of resistance for all the reasons that Dov mentioned, right? Reasons that don't have anything to do with Iran, but have to do with the larger downturn in transatlantic relations. That's going to make it really difficult to try to come to a consensus over how to approach Iran. And it almost guarantees, because China has a veto at the UN Security Council, that any meaningful action, at least through that international organization, is going to be thwarted. And China, as we can see from this deal, has more reason than ever before to provide these avenues for people who want to trade with Iran to circumvent sanctions and to stymie any sort of multilateral action. So we have a real problem on our hands in terms of trying to create a durable, sustainable pressure strategy on Iran when we have Beijing working significantly against us.
Obviously, we're in a presidential campaign season. Do you guys have any sense on how Team Biden is looking at some of these challenges? Because I think it's pretty clear, or at least we have a sense on how Trump is would respond. If in office, what do we know about how Biden would respond? And I should point out to our audience that, Dove, you have endorsed Joe Biden to be president, even though you are a lifelong Republican and come from a family of Republicans and have produced a family of good Republicans.
Well, yeah, I guess that's so. Look, it, of course, it depends on who Biden actually chooses to be his secretaries of state and defense and his national security advisor. And, you know, whatever the press may say about one individual or another, we never really know who predicted Rex Tillerson as secretary of state for Trump. Having said that, those who are advising Biden now, many of them, if not most of them, including Biden himself, have a stake in the old JCPOA. I think they recognize that it can't be exactly the same, but they're going to try to have a new JCPOA, if you will. Secondly, they're clearly committed to cooperation with our European allies. Biden himself, when he was chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee and when he was chairman of the European subcommittee of that committee in the Senate, had tremendous degree of interaction with the Europeans. He's liked there. They were all rooting for him to win, of course. And so I think you'll see a much more collaborative approach. Now, the problem, of course, is that this isn't 2016. If this Chinese-Iranian deal goes through, it's a very, very different environment. That's what we've been saying throughout this podcast. And so even with the best of will, it's going to be tough for a Biden administration to reverse what looks like a new course in the Middle East. It's going to take a lot of hard work. It's going to take a lot of walking a lot of cats back, and that will not be easy.
Ilan?
Well, no, look, I think you have to look at sort of what this looks like from Tehran. And if you are the Iranian supreme leader, if you're in the leadership positions in Tehran, you're obviously looking at two very different strategies on the part of a continuation of the Trump administration vice Biden administration. And, you know, the supreme leader has said as much. He gave a televised address on August 1st in which he essentially said that the nuclear program would continue, and he refuses to meet with President Trump, and he refuses to negotiate at all. And he said this is because he does not want Trump to have a political victory that he can parlay into some sort of electoral gains the way he has done with North Korea before, right? And I think that tells you something. It tells you that the Ayatollahs believe that a Biden administration is likely to adopt a more accommodating stance, right? Whether that means returning back to the JCPOA framework or using that as a jumping off point to talk about a new agreement, it doesn't mean that the Iranian regime thinks that the Democrats are good for them necessarily, but they do want a sort of pivot. And you can sort of see this in the way that they're approaching the discussions. It doesn't mean that they don't think America is going to be an adversary under Biden by any stretch. But I do think that they are very concerned, at least with the pace that maximum pressure is moving currently. And they're worried that the situation is unsustainable if maximum pressure continues.
Let's talk brief. We've got a couple of minutes left, and I want to talk about Jordan and what's going on there, as well as what's going on in Israel. Dov, where are we on how Bibi is doing and the support that he has, given that there is discontentment with how he's handled the whole coronavirus episode?
Well, you know, had he handled it badly from the start, he'd probably actually be better off now than he is. And the reason I say that is that everybody thought he was doing fine and that he was on top of it. And now it's come back with a vengeance, which means that he's seen to have dropped the ball after having been paying attention to this. So everybody's focusing on the fact that this is a guy who's totally self-absorbed, who sounds familiar, who is under indictment, who probably should have resigned from this post anyway. And many people suspect that he wants a fourth election, because each time he calls an election, he is still the interim prime minister until the election is over. And then he puts together a government that lasts for as long as he wants it to last and calls another election. This will be a fourth. Nobody trusts him, of course, but nobody ever has. That's never been the issue. The issue was always national security. He made himself out to be the national security prime minister and the economy prime minister. The economy did exceedingly well under him. But now, as in America, the economy has headed south. They've got, I forget how high the unemployment rate is. I believe it's 20% or more. And so all of a sudden, it's the economy, stupid, doesn't work in his favor. He's still under indictment. The disease is not under control yet. And tourism, of course, which is a major input to the Israeli economy, is going nowhere fast. So there's tremendous discontent. Whether he can weather this again, as he has in the past, people are saying perhaps not this time. But with this guy, you just never know.
Ilan?
No, I think all of that is right. And you can see Bibi sort of bobbing and weaving to preserve his hold on power. And, you know, one of the ways you can see it is that there's now a debate over the disposition of the national budget in Israel, right? The coalition that he had cobbled together when Benny Gantz was in a much better political position, when his blue and white coalition hadn't yet fallen apart, because it now has, suggested a two-year emergency budget to sort of to carry the country through the pandemic. And Bibi doesn't want that. He wants a one-year budget. And he wants a one-year budget because, frankly, I think he's already eyeing the idea that he may dissolve the government sometime over the next year and go into what would effectively be a fourth round of elections, because eyeing the political landscape, he's in a better position now than he was during the last election, because the coalition partner that he was forced to take, Benny Gantz, has less seats now and less political clout now, right? So this becomes intensely personal for all the reasons that Dov mentioned. But, you know, Bibi is nothing if not a political survivor. And even in the midst of the pandemic, even in the midst of, you know, this very significant economic and health crisis, he's taking a look at what the political winds, which way the political winds are blowing.
There's another thing too, Bago. You know, he looks at what's his electorate like. Okay, so he's got the settlers in his pocket. They're not going to go anywhere else. And even if they vote for another settler type party, that party will go into coalition. He's got the ultra orthodox. Same reason. The deal he makes with them is he gives them budget money for their institutions, and they leave him alone to do whatever else he wants. That's not going to change whether or not they vote for him or they vote for an ultra-Orthodox party. Then you've got the Russians. The Russians are split. A lot of them are as right-wing as the settlers. The big competitor to Bibi is Lieberman. But his clout is not as great as it was. He's in opposition now, and he might be there again. So if you start looking at that coalition, and then you add to that the non-religious, non-Arab, non-Russian, non-settler, but longtime supporters of Bibi's party, the Likud, he's practically there. He may not be at a majority, but he's not a minority. So he's just calculating, I think, as Ilan says, when between now and roughly 18 months from now is the best time to call an election, knowing full well. I mean, frankly, Donald Trump would be jealous, because Bibi has a base that's roughly 48 to 49% of the electorate at a minimum. And it's just a matter of timing for Bibi, and that's why he could be back again.
Let's talk briefly about Jordan. Obviously, King Abdullah, I think King Hussein used to say it, artfully, that Jordan is always caught between Iraq and a hard place, but I'm bum. King Abdullah has been faced with an unprecedented challenge, obviously, with the Syrian refugee crisis. It was made worse by Russia. It was made worse by Turkey. And now the government is starting to become much more repressive in how it's trying to put down demonstrations across the country. On this one, Ilan, why don't you start us off? Because I know you've been watching it very carefully, because there have been concerns that the king could be in trouble. And when what does that mean if something very bad were to happen regionally, given that Jordan has been one of the stable nations in the region?
Right. Well, so it bears, from the outside, it bears noting that the thing that King Abdullah was most concerned about hasn't actually happened, right? The thing that was occupying him earlier this summer was the possibility that the Israeli government would move forward with annexation of parts of the West Bank and the Jordan River Valley, right, in a way that the at least the king was posturing would be a casus belli. That hasn't happened. And frankly, it hasn't happened because not because the king was public in his opposition, but because Bibi Netanyahu sort of very, I think, very cagily understood that it would cause all sorts of problems from the capital that he really cares about, which isn't Amman, it's actually Washington. But beyond that, when you know Jordan looks at the landscape, it is seeing, frankly, you know, what it's seeing is causing a lot of consternation. It's seeing a resilient Islamic State terrorist group, one that is metastasizing, it's migrating in a whole bunch of sort of into a whole bunch of world regions, but also showing new signs of life, even in the core caliphate of Iraq and Syria. It's grappling with, as you said, with a very significant Syrian refugee flow. And it's also beginning to acknowledge and act against an upsurge of domestic Islamist sentiment. The Jordanian Court of Cassation earlier this summer basically outlawed the Muslim Brotherhood or the Jordanian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. And it did that because, you know, there is a creeping sense in Jordan that, you know, Islamist tendencies, which were held at bay more or less over the last few years, paradoxically, now that the Islamic State is gone or mostly gone, are actually rearing their head inside the country in a way that they weren't before. So, you know, you stack all of that together and the Jordanian king has a lot to be worried about.
Dove?
Well, first of all, the last time Jordan really was in trouble was in 1970 when the Palestinians' Black September almost took over Jordan and the Israelis bailed King Hussein out. If Israel had annexed anything, it would have been very difficult for King Abdullah to rely on the Israelis. It looks like if something really bad were to happen, the Israelis could intervene again if they needed to. Probably with American support, although who knows what Mr. Trump would be saying at any given moment, but nevertheless, probably with American support. Now, here's where it gets complicated. The Muslim Brotherhood is supported by Turkey. That's number one. So, and Turkey has become an increasingly active player throughout the Middle East, even willing to take on the French in the Mediterranean because they wanted to ship arms to Libya. Will the Turks get involved in some way, if only to help out the Brotherhood? So that's one aspect. Another aspect is, I don't think people realize that whereas when the perhaps the first wave of Syrian refugees were reasonably well off, most of the refugees for the last, five or six years are poor people, which means that they have little to lose, number one, and they're dependent on whatever the state can give them, except that Jordan is a very poor state. So that's another problem for the king. And finally, you can't ignore the fact of the majority of Jordanians are Palestinian, including the king's wife, the queen. And so he always has to keep an eye on making sure that the Palestinians are not so discontented that they would be willing to overthrow him. He's got problems coming from multiple directions. Right now, it looks like the only place that he can really rely on, by the way, it wouldn't necessarily be the Saudis, partly because the Saudis are preoccupied, partly because there's never been love lost between the Najdi Saudis and the Hejazi Hashemites. The only real place is probably Israel with American support. And then the question is, how visible would Israeli intervention be? It's not in his interest to have it very visible. So that also is a complicating factor. He is in a very tight spot. But the wonderful thing about the descendants of the prophet, which is what he is they somehow managed to wriggle out of tight spots like no one else can.
You know, to avoid the entire region and the United States and its allies being in a tight spot, you've got to keep your fingers crossed for the Jordanians. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us. We appreciate it. Would love to talk about this issue again in the future. It's always a pleasure having you guys on. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Vago.
Thanks for having me.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.